You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, open source, community, solar-powered radio from the cultural district here in the lovely town of Fairfield, Iowa.
Yeah, and the sun's trying to shine today.
And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Writers' Voices. Today we have Alan Cobb, and he has written a book called The Rules for the Game of Life. You're going to find it very interesting. That voice in your head has something to tell you. A novel, a parable, a glimpse into one man's internal dialogue revealing unexpected rules from an unverified source. His life is punctuated by tantalizing cosmic insights from God, from an alter ego, or possibly just a big misunderstanding. And he has been talking to himself.
The author has
been talking to himself about the inner and outer experience through poetry, essays, music, and fiction for half a century. His work is always innovative and entertaining. Some call him the village explainer, an epitaph he finds somewhat appropriate but embarrassing.
And the village he's referring to is our own Fairfield at this point in time, because Alan is a Fairfield author, novelist, poet, publisher, musician, and sound artist. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Alan.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
How long have you been in Fairfield?
I've been here since 2001.
Okay.
So about 12.
So you're almost a newbie.
Yeah. by most standards. I remember when I lived in Vermont, I knew people who had lived there for only one or two generations.
Of course.
And they were still considered to be from out of state.
Yes, yeah. And where did you come to Iowa from?
Well, I came here from Malibu, and prior to that, Lake Tahoe, and prior to that, Santa Monica, and then New York City.
And Vermont somewhere
Switzerland
along the way.
Vermont, Connecticut, and upstate New York for my youth, yeah.
Okay.
And Maine. I shouldn't leave out Maine. My grandfather bought an island on a lake in Maine in the 20s of the last century. And so all the family goes up there every summer, and the extended family lives
still
off the grid, yeah, for a while. It's a tiny island.
Wow.
So it's not all the family at once.
It's great, though, that they have that place, isn't it?
It's fantastic. And it turns out the lake that it's on is actually Golden Pond. It's the novelist who wrote that book, Summers on the Lake. But its real name is Great Pond. It's one of the Belgrade lakes. And when they made the movie of it, they decided that Great Pond didn't look enough like a main lake. So they used, I forget the name now, in a lake in New Hampshire that looked more like a main lake to somebody in Hollywood.
Oh, you never know.
Well, the result is that Great Pond isn't entirely paved over as the one in New Hampshire now is.
Oh, it's now a tourist destination.
Yeah, every selling property made sure that you knew it was Golden Pond from the movie.
Right.
So
right.
we're happy to be
the real Golden
operating
Pond.
Operating under the lesser-known name.
Don't tell anybody.
Great Pond. Right. The Belgrade Lakes.
The Belgrade Lakes.
Yeah.
Now, that's really a coincidence, because my friend who's staying at my house, Jeffrey Smith, is on his way to Belgrade as we speak.
The Belgrade.
Which, yeah. You know, is not, yeah. Well, he's on his way to Chicago and then from there to Belgrade, which is not some place that people normally go from Fairfield. So that's kind of an odd coincidence.
Yeah, it's a good one. Well, of course, Maine is notorious for having tiny towns named after major world cities, Rome and Paris and Madrid.
There's a Madrid, Iowa, Rome, Iowa.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if there's a Paris, Iowa, too.
Yeah, it may have just been something people did back then.
Yeah, I think so.
Could be.
Transplants from Europe looking for signs of home.
Right, right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your new book, The Rules for the Game of Life. What led you to write this book?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, sometimes people just sit down and write a long story. And in this case, I had no idea I was going to write it. For the last 30 or 40 years, I've been collecting a series of sort of fake aphorisms, you might say.
What is the difference between a fake aphorism and a real aphorism?
Well, these aphorisms are kind of instructions that mm-hmm. you should, you know, take to heart and use them as rules of thumb. But one of mine is there are no rules of thumb. They started coming to me when I was living in Switzerland and working with Maharishi. And I remember one day I was walking up the hill to the Hotel Prachley in Arosa. And I had this thought, boy, you really have to play the game, don't you? That's one option that isn't there is playing. You have to play. And then I thought, well, that's kind of like one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt play the game. And then I thought, well, that's interesting. And another half mile up the mountain, I thought of another one, and that was, thou shalt not necessarily be told the rules. And I thought, you know, we get some rules, but they're not all that predictable. And then I realized some of them are kind of subject to change, too. They make sense until you outgrow them, and then you need a different rule because it just wasn't worded the right way. So over the decades, I collected a dozen or more of them, and I had a file of candidate rules that had. They all had to have that kind of wry, minimalist quality of thou shalt play the game, which is almost perverse. You know, it's like, well, why tell me if that's the case? And I would read them to people once in a while, and often they would say, oh, you ought to put those in a book or something. And I'd be thinking, yeah, right, an 18-page book. That'll be great.
So, pamphlet.
A pamphlet, yeah. Well, in fact, a business card is quite adequate for them. I keep them in my wallet on a card that fits nicely and without folding. And so finally, last fall, I said to myself, okay, I'm overdue writing something. I don't know what to write, so I'm just going to sit there and write something, and I've got the rules. And I had just recently organized them, gotten rid of all the ones I didn't like. And boiled them down from about 24 to 18. And so I thought, all right, well, I'll just use that as a framework and I'll write a series of 18 little humorous essays. And about two or three paragraphs in on the first one, I realized I wasn't writing an essay. I was writing a story about a young man starting out a little bit after college, doesn't quite know what to do with himself, and he's sitting in a pine tree on the edge of his parents' side lawn, which is something he's been doing since he was a little kid. But
his parents are deceased.
His parents have passed away, and his sister and brother-in-law now live in the big house, and he's kind of persona non grata, hanging out there trying to figure out what he's going to do. And he hasn't gotten a job after college, and he was sure he would. And his friends are getting jobs. And so he's sitting in this tree, and there's this kind of twinkling light out at the end of one of the branches. And he looks at it, wondering what it is. And then it kind of blossoms into a light inside his head, followed by a voice that says, Harvey, welcome to the game of life. And then he proceeds to have this dialogue with the voice in his head about each one of the rules. Each chapter is another one of these rules. But instead of explaining the rules, it's much more fun to listen to a sort of an innocent protagonist saying, but why tell us that? Why are you bothering to tell me that thou shalt play the game? If I have to play the game anyway, it's kind of doesn't really help. It's not like a rule. And then he says, well, what happens if I break a rule? Do you punish me? And the voice says, I don't punish. Well, by this time, he's already said, well, who are you anyway? Am I just losing my mind? And the voice says, no, you're not losing your mind. This is the voice of God. And Harvey says, that's just not plausible. I'm sorry. I can't buy that. And we find over the course of these 18 rules, which are spread out over about 80 years of his life, that it's not important whoever it is, if it is God, it's not important to God that he believes that it's God. And it's not important to Harvey, really. And in fact, many of the rules aren't that important either. Because life intrudes. You know, you get these rules and you know, okay, now I've got a rule. We'll see how this applies. And it's a novel, so it'll apply really neatly in my next real-life situation. But the next chapter is, you know, 5 years later, and he's completely forgotten about the rules. He got married. And he's got a new job, and he moved to California, and stuff is happening. And he's not thinking about a voice in his head from 10 years ago that gave him some abstract, you know, statement about the nature of life or something. And so that's kind of the way it goes. He learns these things, and he forgets them, and it's told in a kind of almost like a parable. Except that it's very low pretense, and the voice makes it very clear that pretense is not welcome. We just want to, like, be simple and everyday about all of this. And so by the end of the book, the real question for Harvey is, were the rules even important? If the voice wasn't trying to convince him of anything and the rules weren't important, then what was important? And I guess that's a question I could write another book trying to answer. But I'm hoping that this book answers that question by the time someone's finished reading it. You know, it's kind of a puzzle, but at the same time, it's like, you know, knowledge doesn't come to us in life with flashing lights.
Generally. It did in this case.
Just the first time, and the voice admits that the flashing light was just for effect. It was just to get his attention. It doesn't bother doing it again. Actually, it had done it earlier in the prologue, too. The prologue is Harvey is maybe a year old, and he's propped up in a chair. And in hindsight, after reading the prologue, we can kind of conclude that the voice probably came to him, but he didn't understand language yet, so whatever it was the voice was saying, it was just a pleasant sound that made him laugh.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Alan Cobb. We're talking about his new book, The Rules for the Game of Life.
Okay, let me ask you this. There's rule when he's a young man.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say later on he probably has forgotten it, but could he have internalized that and been following it and not realizing it?
I think so, but part of what's unusual about these rules is that they're really not rules that are telling you how to behave. They're more rules that describe the way it works.
Mm.
You know, one of Harvey's early concerns is, well, what happens if I don't obey the rules? You know, if you're God, what are you going to do to me? And God says, well, nothing. In one case, the consequence is that you become very bored, and you can get stuck in boredom and end up missing life.
Mm-hmm.
And Harvey says, well, so that's the punishment? And the voice says, that's not a punishment. That's a consequence. And in most cases, the rules are not breakable. They're not things that you could, they're like laws of nature. You don't have to worry about disobeying the law of gravity. Some people worry about stuff like that, but hopefully not too many. But in another sense, you're quite right. I think he does internalize them, and it gives him a perspective on the way it works. And I think an important aspect of the way it works is that you can't analyze the way it works, and you can't break it down into a simple set of rules. So the book is kind of denying itself.
This is most interesting.
Well, it's a paradox inside a conundrum.
Wrapped in an enigma. Well, it has a very vaguely, sort of in a friendly tone, a vaguely Beckett quality to it. There's only one proper name in the entire book, and that's Harvey. No one else has a name. Yeah. We never find out anybody's name. We never follow him into activity after he's been given another rule, because all that's relevant is his response to life, and his response to life is like everyone else's. We respond in different ways to different things, and stuff happens, and then we react to it. And the rules come up at the at times when Harvey is not so absorbed that he isn't open to a little input from Mother Nature, or in this case, a voice in his head.
Now, you talked about, you know, this was a way of basically sharing the rules that you have gathered. Did you get them from a voice in your head?
Well, you know, there's a wonderful paradox in that whole line of thinking that has to do with writing itself. And as I'm sure everyone who's done any writing at all knows, in a sense, you really don't know where it's coming from. You know what you're going to say, but you don't really know what you're going to say. You know sort of where you're going to head, but then it comes out. And if it's a story, you almost certainly don't know what's going to happen. And the characters, I mean, every novelist I've ever read who writes about writing has, you know, marveled at how you just don't know what's going to happen at all. They tell you, the characters tell you, they write the story.
Right. You think it's going to go one way and then it goes somewhere else.
Yeah.
The character just takes over and someone who might, you thought was a minor character becomes a major character.
Right. And that's what happened with this. I mean, the voice in Harvey's head, which I was making up and, you know, conforming to my vision of, you know, what it might be like if God were just a regular guy and came and gave you some friendly, you know, advice and didn't expect a whole lot and to go on besides that. And, you know, that voice took on a personality which was quite different from Harvey's. And Harvey starts out a little dull. You know, he's 24 years old and he hasn't really figured out what he's doing, and he's lost a lot of confidence because he hasn't had any success yet. And you know, we all were there at one time or another, somewhere around that age. And later on, he's reacting to things like the loss of his wife, or retiring to Lake Tahoe, or ending up in a home in Reno. But the whole time there is this possibility of some contact with the voice. And the voice does show him some stuff that is a little more on the cosmic side towards the end of the book. But the real message of the voice isn't the rules. And the real message of the whole book is, in a sense, not the rules. The rules are what they are, just as, you know, life is what it is. But understanding it means getting your head out of it, out of the details and out of the rules and beyond all of that. And I think very, very subtly we're saying to him along the way that we're kind of showing the reader along the way that the voice comes out of silence. And that's really the message, but that's a nonverbal message. And you can't really do that in a book. You have to dance around it.
That's a little tough, yeah.
So this is hopefully an enjoyable dance around silence.
You should have that on your back cover.
Yeah, it's a good phrase.
It is. Write that one down.
A dance around silence.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Alan Cobb. We're discussing the rules for the game of life. Now, whenever I see, let me ask this first. How autobiographical is this? How much do you identify with Harvey?
It's a good question. In a sense, I don't identify with Harvey at all. But the experiences that he's had in some distorted form or another are taken from my own experience. But in a similar sort of way, the voice is coming from my own experience too. You know, there isn't any TM movement jargon in the book anywhere, but a substantial part of the simplicity that the voice represents is, you know, my take on Maharishi and what I learned working with him for 5 years. So there are biographical bits. I mean, actually, there is a house in upstate New York with a big pine tree that I used to climb.
And Malibu, and, you mentioned
and
Malibu.
And Malibu, and I've lived in these places. But yeah. I think, you know, writers tend to draw from places they've actually been.
Right.
Now, the next thing I'm working on goes all over the place where I haven't been. And I've got to say, this is a new experience that just wasn't possible a few years ago, being able to write about places that I haven't been with Wikipedia and Google on the screen to my left.
You can do your research.
You can do street level view of the house in a city you've never been in, and talk about the store on the corner and the tree lined parks.
That kind of undermines the writer's ability or to claim that any trip they take is research. Yes, and they can write it off for tax purposes.
That's right. But on the other hand, you get to buy really, really advanced computers so that you can have instant access to 20 or 30 different Wikipedia and Google searches all at once.
I never even thought about using Google Maps to...
Well, there's a... I just finished Google Earth.
Yeah.
I just finished... Well, Google Maps, too, because there's a street view icon that you click on that, and suddenly you're looking at the building. And,
yeah.
I just finished a short story, which I hope we might have time to read this weekend, which is... It hops all over the place, and part of it takes place in Italy, where a friend of mine was looking for his ancestral home. And so I was able to describe him landing at the correct airport and taking a puddle jumper to the correct airport and then renting a plausible rent-a-car in Italy and driving it up a particular state route to a certain other place where he got on the provincial road and went through the switchbacks in the such and such forest and ended up in the town of Corsiglia.
Wow.
And it just adds an element of reality to it that makes it sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Like you were really there.
Yeah. And as the village explainer, of course, I owe that to my audience.
That's right.
Well, Alan, let's actually have you read a bit from the rules right now, and then we'll move on maybe to some other, your other writing experience in publishing.
Okay.
Talk about that.
Do you have any section in particular that...
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you read towards the end, because I didn't have the book for very long, and so I didn't make it the whole way through, and so I want to hear something new. I will say this, though, that it grabbed my attention, and I wanted to keep reading. So that's always
a relief.
That is a good thing.
That's the whole game, pretty much.
Yeah. So.
So what do you think? Chapter 15?
Chapter 15. That sounds great.
Chapter 15, Trees. A few more years slipped by, and Harvey did end up selling his stake in the company. He moved to a year-round cottage at Lake Tahoe and continued trying to adapt to life by himself, without her, and without even an office full of people depending on him. Living at the lake was more peaceful and healing than Harvey had anticipated. As usual, his anticipations had proven utterly unreliable. The thin, clean air was effortless to breathe, and the huge blue lake surrounded by its own private sierras was a constant inspiration. But an inspiration for what? He hadn't done anything since retiring here. Worse yet, the company he left had fallen on bad times and didn't look like it would survive the recession. Before leaving California, he had half-heartedly started planning a new company, something he could do on his own way, the right way, something that would bounce him out of bed every morning like summer itself used to do when he was a kid. But the motivation just didn't run deep enough. He couldn't seem to get it off the ground. Here at the lake, doing big things, doing it right, no longer seemed necessary. Sometimes it felt like he wasn't even doing the physical activity of his own life. Was his personality running on autopilot now? Was he getting too detached? It didn't take long, living at the lake, to discover Sand Harbor and a tiny cove where he could clamber onto a large rock that was completely surrounded by water. The rock was always warm in the sun, even in the winter, and he could sit there and gaze at the lake for hours. He loved the way the afternoon sun glinted off the waves. It reminded him of the first day in the pine tree in New York. He could easily envision the way that the glinting light had swept into his head, filling his mind with light. "It's a big circle, isn't it?" The voice was quieter than usual, and seemed almost like a natural part of his thoughts. "Sort of," he thought. "Did I just think your voice, or is that actually you?" It's me. Oh, hi, said Harvey. Surprisingly, the voice said nothing. That's a twist, Harvey thought. Don't spoil it, said the voice. He watched the lake rippling in the breeze. He wondered if the voice was watching, too, through his eyes. Yes, it whispered. His thoughts turned back to his old company in L.A. What should I have done? I tried to set the company on a better track, but there was just so much entrenched resistance. Nobody likes change, I guess. My God, they fought every improvement I tried to make. You may plant a tree, said the voice. I tried to keep it going, Harvey replied. The voice was silent. I was thinking of starting a new company, but now I don't think it's worth the energy. If your work doesn't give you energy, then consider a different line of work, said the voice. I'm not sure what gives me energy nowadays. I'm 60, and there's a lot less energy than there used to be. There's still plenty of energy to do what needs to be done, though, said the voice. I'm not sure what that would be. You don't need to be sure. Go in the direction that you're leaning. You know, said Harvey, looking up at the mountains that surrounded Lake Tahoe, during the heyday of Virginia City, they cut down all those trees. Yes, I know. The Washeshu must have thought the white men were insane. Indeed they did. People do the damnedest things. But they all grew back, didn't they? Some of them. Not many new ponderosas and Jeffreys yet. No, lots of sugar pine, but most of them are dead. Bark beetles, said the voice. I wonder what we could do to fix this, said Harvey. It will fix itself, said the voice. But how? Half the new growth is dead. Fire, said the voice. But that would be terrible, said Harvey. Getting caught in it would be hard, said the voice, but that's how the old forest got here. Ponderosas don't mind a fire now and then. They're built for it. Clears out all the dead sugar pine, fertilizes the soil, frees up space. It will be beautiful. But people will lose their homes. All these towns and villages could be destroyed. That would be a huge tragedy. Maybe it won't happen that way, said the voice. I sure hope not. Rule 15 is about trees, said the voice. Harvey snapped out of his doomsday vision. Trees? It seems like a good metaphor, said the voice. What's the rule, then? Rule 15. You may plant a tree. You can't grow a tree. Wait a sec. Harvey considered the terse statement. You're saying I can plant a tree, but I can't make it grow? Yes, but I didn't say make it grow, did I? You said I can't grow a tree. What's the difference? You can start something, but you can't control the outcome. You can try to steer your company back to profitability, but you can't make it happen. You can plant a tree, but the tree has to do the growing. So this is the rule I should have known 3 years ago. Right. What good is the rule if you don't tell me until after it applies? Sometimes that's the only time it will make sense to you. But then it's too late. Not if it applies again at another time. Oh. Harvey looked again at the forested mountains framing the lake. The setting sun was casting a deep red-orange glow along the western ridge. He hoped the forest wouldn't catch fire, even if it was good for the Jeffrey pines. I see what you mean about the tree, said Harvey. Yes, said the voice. They take care of themselves, but there are other factors. Like us, said Harvey in a gloomy tone. They needed the wood. But they destroyed the forest. You want more? More what? Forest? Well, yes, look at it. It's not a forest, it's a tinder pile. You want more ponderosas? Yes, Harvey paused. But I don't want a forest fire. You absolutely have my permission to plant a ponderosa. You absolutely lack the ability to make it grow. But you can nurture it, but that's external to the growing. You can water it and protect it from frost or whatever else you think might help. But in all cases, you're only making changes to enable the tree to do its own thing more successfully. You're not doing its thing yourself. You're not even directly helping. The tree's own biology does the growing, not me. So if it lives or dies, it's not my fault. No, not at all. Living or dying could certainly be your fault, just like this forest. But when it comes to the growing, you can't grow it. You can help or ruin the outcome by messing with the situation, but you can't do tree growing. I understand. The tree does all the growing. Actually, it doesn't. I do. I knew you were going to say that. Yes, but of course I don't really do anything. It's all preset. Are we going to talk about free will again? No. Did you want to? God, no. Pause. Sorry. You don't have to keep apologizing for using the word God. It's always good to think of me. I'm not easily offended. In fact, it's impossible. At any given moment, throughout the universe, you can't imagine how many beings are berating me for this and that. Being omnipotent, though, it truly cannot bother me. And being omniscient, I can't help loving them all anyway. Harvey didn't know what to say.
That was Alan Cobb reading from The Rules for the Game of Life, and you are listening to Writer's Voices. So, Alan, sometimes when I pick up a book like this that sort of is embodying some philosophy, mm-hmm. I wonder if the author, you know, it's sort of like you're setting yourself up to be a wise person.
Yeah, right. And yeah, a dangerous place to
right,
set oneself.
Exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I guess I dealt with it by making the voice completely unconcerned with being wise or anything else, or with convincing anyone of anything. It's funny, too, because, I mean, it's not really in my character to be acting like that. In fact, there's one place where Harvey says, well, the situation is that he realizes that, you know, God, if this is God, is talking to him directly, and doesn't that, in a sense, make him some kind of a prophet? And God says, oh, heavens, no. No, you're not a prophet. Please don't start prophesying. And Harvey says, no, don't worry, I won't. So there's a sense of the you know, outrageous idiocy of someone claiming to be God.
Or to know the rules.
Or to know the rules. And if it weren't for this particular set of rules, the knowing of which doesn't really change anything very much, they're almost anti-rules. You know, it's almost a satire on wisdom, except that I think there is some real wisdom in there, such as I've gathered so far. But it's presented in such a way that hopefully it's completely dismissible. You know,
to me makes it more believable.
I think it does. I mean, that's kind of the sneaky aspect of all of this. It has many levels of self-contradiction.
We're back to the paradox.
Yeah, there are a lot of paradoxes. And in fact, that's one of the things that never made it into the rules that I've always thought of. It's just it's too profound to actually include in the rules, because they have their tongue in their cheek a little bit. And that's that whenever we come to understand something really deeply, the understanding becomes paradoxical. Mm. And I think the essence of that is something contained in one of the last chapters in this book, and that is that it's too big to understand. We want to understand, and the equipment that we've got for understanding things is really good for opening the door, looking at the situation, asking some good questions. But it's not good for actually getting the answer, because the complete answer isn't conceptual. It doesn't fall into the realm of language, and it can't be. You're lucky if you get glimpses of comprehension. The idea of actually being able to package that comprehension and make it available for somebody else is just pushing it way too far. And so the question then is, how do you deal with learning things? What are we actually learning? Because we're clearly here to learn. That's a large part of what life is all about. And I think the message in the rules is that, yeah, we're here to learn, but the ultimate thing to learn doesn't operate in that domain of facts and ideas and concepts and language and expressions and aphorisms and rules. It's all made out of intelligence, but the scale of it is just way, way too big.
And it can't really be taught.
It can't be taught. It can't be said. Yeah. And, you know, poets and writers and painters and musicians all try to express their reaction to it, but they're not expressing it.
Now, are there any books or authors that you that you would compare this book to?
Wow. I the only comparisons I've ever come up with, and again, these are, you know, this might suggest a terrible personal conceit, but Samuel Beckett is one of my idols. And in a strange, lighthearted sort of way, I see this as very Beckett-like.
And what era did he write in?
Well, he wrote during the Second World War. Okay. He worked extensively in France in the underground against the Nazis, and he wrote immortal plays like Waiting for Godot. His novels are An Endgame and Crap's Last Tape. Those are the ones people are most likely to have heard of. And he has what most people consider to be a very bleak vision of the world and of life. But it's not really adequate to call it bleak. What's happened with Beckett is that he has seen far enough into reality to realize that you have to make some kind of acknowledgement of the sacred. And yet, when you can't find it around you in the relative, it just seems like something's wrong. There's a very important speech in the middle of Waiting for Godot where this mute servant named Lucky, who labors through Act One and Act Two with this big set of bags and things and a rope around his neck, and he's driven by this country gentleman named Pazzo, which is the Italian word for crazy. At one point, the two tramps whom we watch as the sort of the center of the play discover that Lucky can speak. And Pazzo says, yes, he used to be quite good at it at one time, but you know, such as it is, and you want to hear him speak? And they say, well, yeah, we'd like to, because they've been like waiting for Godot for ages. We don't know how long, but probably forever. And so he cracks his whip and tells Lucky to speak, and Lucky puts down his bags and starts lumbering around, and he delivers this speech, which is 100% unintelligible. If you're in a theater audience hearing it for the first time, there's almost no possibility that you could ever understand anything from it, other than that it's full of phrases, meaningless phrases that sound like insane scholarship. Things like qua, 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 outside the realm of Vesey and Posse, and, you know, as... notwithstanding the writings of, you know, Fulham and Clapham and so on. And it just goes on and on. And he gets more and more excited and agitated giving this speech until finally he looks downright dangerous and he's kind of lumbering around waving his arms and everyone's getting very upset about it. And finally Pazzo cries out, "His hat, his hat!" And they manage to snatch off his hat and he instantly goes silent. And this is the most dramatic moment, in a sense, in Act One. In Act Two, of course, we find out that Lucky is still mute and Pazzo doesn't remember him ever having spoken. But
you know, I've never seen this play.
It's an amazing play.
I
highly recommend it. It's one of the great defining plays of the English language, and certainly of the 20th century.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
But if you read the play... if you read the script and you read through Lucky's speech, which is 3 pages, single-spaced, no punctuation, it's very easy to find that there is, in fact, a tiny shred of syntax that's scattered across those 3 pages. And it goes like this. Given the existence of a personal God outside of time, man wastes and pines, wastes and pines. that's what Lucky is saying, and it's shrouded in meaningless scholarship, which isn't even scholarship, it's just the noises of scholarship. And it makes him and everyone else very upset to hear it. And that's, in fact, what you could say in glowing letters is the author's message of Waiting for Godot, which is that, you know, they're waiting for Godot. We don't know who Godot is. They don't know who Godot is.
Godot, of course, is spelled
G-O-D-O-T. He's Irish, and so the people from the UK tend to pronounce it Godot. However, he wrote this play in French, as he did many of his works, because it limited his vocabulary and limited his pretentiousness, and he liked the simplicity that came out from writing in another language. Wow. And then he translated it into English.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so here he's written this thing, and in France, G-O-D-O-T would not be pronounced Godot, it would be pronounced Godot. So I think that's an appropriate pronunciation for it. And it makes it a little less certain that Godot is Godot.
Yeah.
At the end of each act, there's only two acts, but at the end of each act, a little boy appears, the personification of innocence. And he basically delivers in both acts the same message, which is, I have a message from Mr. Godot, which implies he must exist. He says to tell you he's not coming today, but surely tomorrow. And so then we have these four characters on stage. Vladimir and Estragon, the two hobos who are just on this country road waiting. And they can't leave because he might come tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And we have Pazzo and Lucky who pass through. And what they do is they go on. Mm-hmm. And these are the choices of humanity, to wait or go on. But in both cases, given the existence of a personal God outside of time, what can you hope for? You have to keep hoping, but what's it going to get you? And that's kind of Beckett in a nutshell.
Okay. And is that what
now the way he gets these?
Too?
Yeah, the way he gets these things across is, I think, akin to what I'm trying to do in the rules, except I don't see it as a bleak situation, because I've seen through the veil a little bit, and to me, you're not waiting for anything, and just because God is outside of time doesn't mean you have to waste and pine. It means that he's outside of time, and if your consciousness can access something beyond the immediate world, then it's not a bad thing. And of course, the secret here is that you are God, not that you're trying to find God.
Chris, when he was writing, he was seeing the worst of humanity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he started in the UK, and his family, he came from a upper middle class family, so he wasn't a starving artist by a long shot. But his family didn't really approve of what he was doing, and he'd taken a couple of different positions, teaching and things like that, and none of it was leading anywhere. And then the war came, and he spent a few years in France after the war, and then I think eventually he settled in France. But he did write novels, and they are much more like what you'd expect from someone who was, you know, mired in the advance of the Nazis in France. They're very hard to read. They're like, you know, in terms of general difficulty, it's like reading Joyce.
Oh.
Which
I tried once.
It's kind of endless stream of consciousness. There is a thread of a story going on. In the sense that there's a thread of a story in the rules, but we don't get bogged down in Harvey's job. We never find out what he actually does or what his company actually does. There are two chapters dealing with the death of his wife, and we never even find out her name. It simply isn't important. It's just an element in the human experience, and he's the one dealing with it. And in fact, the voice in his head makes a major point of that you know, it was horrible for him, but maybe it wasn't for horrible, her. You know, for her.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what her, Harvey doesn't know what she, you know, was doing next.
I will say, though, that that your writing in here is very clear, and mm-hmm. it's not, you don't get bogged down in the stream of consciousness.
Yes, no, I try to make it very, very simple.
Yeah.
I kept beating myself over the head to keep it simple.
Yeah, and that you know, I was thinking about Joyce the other day, actually, because, and wondering if today someone like that could be a successful writer.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, I actually have a friend who's a very prolific and very accomplished writer, but his writing does tend to be so awesome on the literary level, not so much on the story level and actually understanding what's going on. So you can read this, you can read what he's write, you know, this novel that he's written, and the words are just amazing, and the pictures that he paints are mm-hmm. just so raw and so real, but you don't necessarily really understand what the story is.
Yeah.
I really was wondering, is there, you know, sort of like for Joyce, there was a market for
that. That's true.
That.
People actually read books like that.
They did. And what about today, do you think?
I don't know. I think there are probably just as many people who read literature books, and there are just as many writers writing what will eventually be called literature. But they sure do easily get lost
and it's very hard to make a mishmash. Living doing it.
Yeah, I think it's always been hard to make a living.
I think it has too, because even back in, like, I have actually read a lot recently about the time, the Paris in the 20s and the 30s. I just became, after watching Midnight in Paris, I became very fascinated by that era. And then I got really into The Paris Wife, which was Hemingway's first wife in Paris, and her story, and then I'm reading Sylvia Beach's memoir, and she was the owner of the Shakespeare Company, which is the bookstore where all of them sort of centered. And I went to visit that when I was in Paris last spring, and I bought her memoir from there.
Yeah.
So I find it very interesting. But the truth is that almost all those writers had patrons.
Yeah. That's right.
They had wealthy, often women,
right,
who supported them, and
Alice B. Toklas and all the others.
Yeah,
and so did the painters and sculptors.
Yeah.
I mean, it was
the
patronage was an essential component in the art world. Now it's just big investment bucks.
Yeah,
and it's kind of, I think, fallen on hard times in a sense. There's more money in it than ever, but it's not rewarding art. It's rewarding collectability and marketability.
Right. Well, in the 10 minutes we have left, can we talk a little bit about Mulberry Knoll?
Sure. Yeah, that's my publishing experiment, which is still in the experimental stages.
And I notice on your website there's 6 books that
you've
published.
Yeah, we have 6 titles right now.
Two of them are
yours.
Two of
them are mine, right.
And of the other 4, we've actually had 2 of them on Writer's Voices. We had Elaine Duncan talking about Feathered Space some years ago, and we had Frances Tickey talking about the new vision for Iowa food and agriculture. So why did you decide, now when you were on Writer's Voices maybe 5 years ago, shortly after you had published your poetry book, Cave Paintings, and you'd self-published it, and you really are my sort of leading expert on the self-publishing process. But what made you decide to expand that and become a small press yourself?
Well, I think in a sense it's an illusion. because you don't sell books by making them available. It used to be that the only people who could make a book available were publishers. And they were also the only people who could market and distribute a book. Now that value has been split off. You don't need a publisher to make a book available. And you still need a publisher to distribute it, although it's arguable that whole market of distributed paper product is turning into a bit of a mystery. We don't know exactly where it's going, and this whole electronic publishing and on-demand publishing process is changing so fast that even today I'm getting shocked by the changes that are coming down the road. Like, think about the implications of used ebooks. It's almost a non sequitur. You don't use it. When you buy an ebook, you're just getting an image and it's perfect. And right. When you're done with it, if you were to sell it to someone else, it would be as perfect and untouched as when you first bought it. So why would you sell it to them at a lower price than you originally bought it? What's the advantage of buying it from the publisher as opposed to somehow buying it from an owner?
But how do you transfer it?
Well, that's what Amazon and Apple are about to do, is create a mechanism so that you can sell used ebooks.
Now, why would they want to do that? Doesn't that cut down on the new books that they're selling?
It's a big question, and there are a lot of authors who are thinking, oh, great, this means that nobody will need to buy the book at list price anymore or whatever the normal price is.
Just pass it around.
Yeah, I mean, The Rules is available as a printed book on Amazon at discount for about $15. It's available as a Kindle book for $5, because I just don't think it's fair to charge anywhere near as much for an ebook as for a printed book. It doesn't cost anything. How could it cost as much?
Right.
How could it sell for the same price if it doesn't cost anything to make it?
Yeah.
And I feel bad every time I look at a book that's available on Kindle, but it's like $2 more than the printed version. And and it's because a publisher somewhere has decided to give it an idiotically high price in the hopes that no one will buy the Kindle version, and the bookstores will stay in business.
Okay, well, I certainly
want the bookstores to stay in business, because they're curators now of a field that's 100 times bigger than it was when we actually had thriving bookstores.
Right.
And the thriving bookstores, the Borders, may they rest in peace, and companies like that, were hated for the same reason. They were devouring all of the neighborhood bookstores, and it's gone through many changes. At this point, I think the small bookstores are starting to actually come back, because people want to go to a place where there are people who love books,
right,
and buy their book among books and look at it and handle it and consider it as a work of art in its own right. It's not just the text on the pages. It's the whole thing. And you put it on a shelf and you hand it to people and you dog-ear it and put Post-its inside it and scribble in the margins and violate it in 100 different ways.
Well, now, even with ebooks, I live in Austin and part-time, mm-hmm. and one of the great independent bookstores, Book People, is mm-hmm. about half a mile from where my condo is. And they have a way where you can go, but I haven't quite figured out how to do it yet, but you can go to the bookstore and then you can get your ebooks through them, in a sense, which mm-hmm. is what I would prefer to do. I would prefer to be like, go to a bookstore, look at the books, and they have mm-hmm. these great recommendations from the people who work there and so forth, but then I want the book electronically.
Yeah.
Because I don't like carrying 10 books around with me. I like having it all in there.
Yeah.
So are they coming down the pike with a way that makes that very seamless to be able to then, like if you're in a bookstore and you go to buy a book, that store gets credit for it?
Yes, there are distribution channels gradually appearing that make it possible for a bookstore to act like a bookstore and sell ebooks.
Yeah.
But the whole concept of book is changing, and this new idea. I mean, I find it completely dumbfounding, the idea of used ebooks.
Yeah,
it just the phrase bothers me, and that's going to be something that gets absorbed into this marketplace somehow, and the technology will adapt to what people actually want.
And you can borrow ebooks from your library too.
You can, and you can. the rules is in a special program with Amazon that permits a Kindle owner to borrow if they're a Kindle owner and they're a member of Amazon Prime. They can borrow a copy of the rules for free. And yet, if they do that, I still get paid a little bit.
That's because they've paid their Prime membership, so you're getting some.
Yeah, and Amazon has this sort of escrow fund that they put a couple of million dollars into every year, and then they pay it proportionally to all of their select authors who have had books borrowed.
Now, would you get as much as if the person bought the book?
No, not as much. But then again, you know, the person didn't have to put out anything to get a copy of my book. So that's a good thing.
Now, I am a Kindle owner, and I am a Prime member, and I have borrowed books. You only can borrow one at a time.
Right.
But I think you can keep it as long as you want.
You can keep it as long as you want. Unlike if you lend it to another Kindle owner, where they have to like read it within 2 weeks or something,
and then it reverts back. Yeah,
which is a real
like library.
And not all books can be lent on Kindle.
The author, the publisher, gets to decide whether it's lendable.
I wondered how that works.
Yeah. Sounds complicated.
It is.
Now, in the actual the process of the publishing, which you use Lightning.
I use Lightning Source.
Lightning Source. Has that changed since you did your poetry book, or is it pretty similar?
It's still pretty much the same. They're very good at what they do. I've always had good luck with them. There are one or two little stumbling blocks that require some arcane knowledge to get around. But they all have to do with revisions. And the very fact that you can revise a book is kind of an amazing luxury. It was something you never did before. And it raises questions about ISBN. Should you change the ISBN if you've revised it just a little? Corrected spelling errors? That shouldn't be a new edition.
No.
So I still highly recommend Lightning Source. I'm very happy with that.
Well, at some point we should have you back on to talk more about that whole process and kind of update on that, because we are out of time right now. But so thank you. We've been talking with Alan Cobb, The Rules for the Game of Life, available from Mulberry Knoll, which is mulberryknoll.com. And there's a link there to Amazon, or you can go straight to Amazon.
Yeah. I just assume you go through Mulberry Knoll, because then I'll get a little bit more from Amazon.
And is it also available at our local independent bookstore?
It should be at Revelations, but I still have them in my car and I've got to drop them off.
Okay, well, I will be.
Better get up there.
They'll be there soon.
All right, Mom, you got a closing quote for us today?
I do. You got to try your luck at least once a day, because you could be going around lucky all day and not even know it. Jimmy Dean said that.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.